Good day, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradoxes Sunday School class, and if you would have a seat, we would appreciate it. Dr. Ross is with us today. He's had a little bout with intestinal blockage and just drove over here from the hospital this morning. So he's quite the trooper. And today he'll be talking about, can humans be descended from Adam and Eve and Noah? And is Noah's Ark too fantastic to be true? So stand by for that. Hugh is here next Sunday. On September 7th, we have special guest speakers talking about the Jesus film. So try to be here and bring your friends for that. More people we can get, the better. We will not be watching the Jesus film, but we'll be talking about it. You'll get a card to watch it. Skeptics Forum. Flyers, Tony's been working on them, and John. And they're at your tables, so do that. And they're also going to be on our website. So those of you out there in Cyberland, look for them on the website, and you can print them. Are they available there, Jamie? The flyers on the website. And for instance, here's one here. Just one example. We have some bigger ones too we're making. So, and then next week, I'll bring a list of all the local colleges, and maybe we can form a team to go out and put our posters up on, I mean our flyers up on the posters at the various campuses. Well, we're hoping to make a team to help do that next week. With that, well, let's say a prayer and get started here. Dr. Ross is raring to go here. Eternal Father, we ask for your blessing on this place and this paradox class. Thank you for bringing Dr. Ross back to us from the hospital. Heal him in every way needed. Bless our lesson and the presenter. Give us the audience, wherever we may be, help us with this lesson today, Lord. Tune our brains and spirits to be receptive to what we hear today. In Jesus' name, amen. Dr. Ross?
Well, what Mark said is true. An hour and 40 minutes ago, I was in the hospital and just drove home, got a quick shower, and drove back out. And hey, normally on Saturday morning, I post on my social media sites details about this class. But Friday, I realized I had an abdominal blockage. And it's because I got scar tissue in my intestines from radiation treatment. Good thing is, I'm cancer-free, but I got the scar tissue and ate something I shouldn't have eaten. I'm gradually learning what not to eat. Just don't eat the good stuff. As the doctor said, if you go on a junk food diet, you'll be fine. So he told me I'm the only patient he's ever said that to. So how it all happened, I mean, you know, it's really hard to get the green leafy vegetables when you got that kind of scar tissue. Had to be very careful about taking all the cellulose out, then cooking it to death. So I actually have these little green pills I take that are substitutes, because we were having people over at our house, so I didn't have time to prepare the veggies. But I took too many of those pills, and they kind of coagulated together. So I did not get to post on Facebook and Twitter until literally an hour ago. So a lot of people might think this class isn't happening because I didn't post it, but literally just an hour ago, I put the information up there. So, but you know, all things work together for good, because I'm basically saying this couldn't happen in a worse time. We're having relatives over, you know, over a dozen of them were coming over, and my son dropped his dog off, and a very high needs dog, needs to be played with all the time. And then I got this bout, and I said to my wife, you got to drive me to the hospital. He says, well, all I'm going to do is drop you off and go home. So that's what she did. She dropped me off. But because I've had these bouts before, they knew I only come in when it's really serious. So they actually gave me a painkiller right away, which really helped. Then they did a scan, and then I saw this surgeon coming in. I said, oh, it's never good news when the first doctor you see is a surgeon. And he walked into the room where I was waiting, and he said, you can't be my patient. You're actually working on your computer. You look way too healthy, and you look way too young. So he said, I got to find my patient. And he came back later and said, you know, I just looked at your CT scan. It says you've got a total blockage. You should be in a gurney, and you should be looking really terrible, but you look good. And he said, maybe the CT scan is giving me a false image here. Maybe you only got a partial blockage. He says, you look too good to have a complete blockage. So he said, anyway, I'm going to get you into the hospital, and we're going to do, and I've had it done before, I affectionately call it intestinal draino. They give you this awful tasting stuff to drink, and it basically shows the doctor where the blockage is. And it kind of works like draino. It not only shows you where the blockage is, sometimes it clears it out. I says, hey, if I can avoid surgery, let's go for it. And I knew it was going to be really unpleasant. That stuff tastes awful. And also, there are consequences that last a couple of days. So, but anyway, I get in there, and they put me in emergency, and they had no bed. So they said, we're going to have to keep you all night in emergency. And they put me right beside this guy that was surrounded by police officers. I says, oh no, this is a code gray. Code gray means we've just had to admit into emergency a violent individual who needs treatment. And you could kind of tell because he was handcuffed to the bed. He had restraints on him. But all night long, he was screaming obscenities and trying to get me to help him get these nurses off of him, because he had four male nurses there, plus the police just trying to restrain him. And he just screamed and yelled all night long. And, you know, one of the male nurses came by and said, well, you know, the last time you were here, we had the same situation. And you're the only patient that can handle something like this. So if you don't mind, we're just going to keep you here. And by the way, we got nowhere else to put you except in the waiting room. I says, fine, I'll stay here. So, and, you know, about 8 o'clock in the morning, they finally got me upstairs. So, but all things work together for good for those who love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. Because that surgeon came in to talk to me, and I asked me, well, you know, most of my patients, especially those that are your age, they just don't have much going on upstairs. And you have all this interesting stuff that you do. Tell me more about what you do. So I did, and told him about our scholar community. He says, that seems like something I'd really like to get involved in. And my son's also a medical researcher. Could he join too? So we got talking about it. I had four long conversations with him. He knows about this class. Who knows, he might show up here. But he says, I definitely want to get involved in the scholar community. I got his card. I'm going to send him a note. So, and he wasn't the only one. There was one other besides those two. So it's like, hey, God's got a purpose in this. And I think what really opened the door is when I had that intestinal draino, I knew from experience the way to make it work best is every time they do an x-ray, they have to wait 15 minutes, because what they're basically checking is watching the movement of the draino. If it doesn't move, then they know you're in real trouble and you need immediate surgery. So, and I said, well, the best thing to do is, since you got to wait 15 minutes, go out in the hall and walk as fast as you can for as long as you can, then go back, have them do it again. And they said, well, when did you figure this out? And I said, well, last time I was here, I got the test done in an hour. This time I got it done in 50 minutes. It completely moved down. And the technicians that were in charge basically sat me down and said, hey, tell me exactly what you're doing here. And bottom line, they said, you know, with our ambulatory patients, we can treat double the patients we're treating right now. And because, you know, I had to wait 4 hours for the test because of the people ahead of me. They said, hey, we could have done you together. We can do two patients at once I have one walking, one taking the x-rays. So, and I said, well, they have to walk at least 3 miles an hour. It's better if they walk 4. And they said, well, the other thing we're worried about is that they're going to escape the hospital. And, you know, in fact, every time I was running the hallways, I ran into people there at the hospital saying, hey, are you lost? Are you trying to get out of here? And I said, no, I'm just trying to help the procedure work better. So I basically said, hey, all you need to do is have one employee that watches what's going on in the halls, and you don't have to worry about anybody escaping. So, and this got back to the doctor, so I got to talk to more doctors saying, hey, you're going to save us a lot of money and maybe a lot of surgeries. So this is really great. It opened up a lot of doors. All things really do work together for good for those that are that love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. That's happened in every single hospital visit I've been involved in. Probably the most dramatic thing that ever happened, this was, 18 years ago, where I came back from a flight from Australia and was in a middle seat in economy. And we're talking 18 hours sitting in that seat, not being able to get out. And when I got back home, I could tell something's wrong, and my wife could tell. And so they wound up doing an angiogram on me, found that my widowmaker artery was totally blocked. So they did surgery on me. Turned out it was a clot, had nothing to do with cholesterol, just a clot. Cleared it out. And so I now tell people that, hey, in fact, what the surgeon said, whenever you're involved in anything athletic, you got an advantage. You got 5 clear arteries instead of 4 because we did a bypass. And yeah, I did notice a difference after the surgery. So even physically, all things worked together for good. But what's interesting is that after the surgery, they said, hey, we got you on meds. You're going to feel good for about the next 90 minutes. Then you're going to feel really terrible. And so for the next 90 minutes, would you mind giving one of your lectures? And so there were 40 nurses and doctors in the ICU, and I gave the lecture, took their questions, and, you know, all things really do work together for good. So you never know. So, hey, if you ever wind up being in the hospital, and hey, when you get as old as I do, it's inevitable that'll happen. So recognize there's a mission field there. And one thing I've noticed about hospitals, whether it is other patients or the doctors or the nurses or just the people that are doing the paperwork, the very environment opens up opportunities to share the gospel. You know, people are in trouble, they're facing death, they're actually willing to talk about the most important issues of life. So, anyway, back to the lesson. Okay. Since we don't have Ross here, I'm actually going to give you one of his typical dad jokes. The only thing that flat earthers fear is fear itself. Okay. You can take that home and tell your kids, they'll love it, right? Okay, we're talking about Noah's Flood. The book is now available. You can actually order it on Amazon, pre-order it. Won't be released until the first week of October. But I'm actually going to be speaking about this in 2 conferences, one in October and one in November. One in November will be fun because I'm going to be debating 3 theologians who I actually mention in the book and critique. So this is their opportunity to critique me. So it's going to be a 4-way debate. They disagree with one another. They all disagree with me. So it should be fun. That's going to be the Evangelical Theological Society. So where we left off last week is that there's a huge debate that's relevant to the flood on the origin of human beings. In fact, Reasons to Believe, I think, is the only science faith organization that actually holds to the position that all of humanity is descended from one man and one woman that God specially created relatively recently, sometime, they say, between 50 and 150,000 years ago. The reason no one else does is they're persuaded by these mathematical genetics models that it's impossible to actually hold to the position that all humans are descended from one man and one woman in the relatively recent past. And as I mentioned last week, these math genetics models are mathematical models based on assumptions that open the door for huge systematic errors. And the reason why people think that this definitively challenges what the Bible teaches, and basically saying the story of Adam and Eve has to be allegorical rather than historical and literal, is the fact that these models are all saying we have to be descended from multiple individuals, thousands of individuals, not just two, and not just 100 to 150,000 years ago, but millions of years ago. But again, they're assuming that these naturalistic evolutionary models are correct, that indeed we humans are descended from a common ancestor with the Neanderthals and the chimpanzees. Now, challenging that are field experiments. Field experiments are telling us that yes, and again, one of the reasons why this is so pervasive is the scientific papers that talk about these genetics measurements of when and how many were descended from, they only give you the statistical errors. They do not give you the systematic errors. And so you look at the numbers that they quote. Hey, 109,000 years ago, plus or minus 24,000 years. Those plus or minus 24,000 years are basically the statistical scatter and what they see in the measurements of a current genetic diversity and the mathematical assumptions. And basically what they're doing is they're looking at all of humanity today, looking at the genetic diversity, making assumptions of how the genetic details change over time and wind up with a date and the number of individuals we're descended from. But they have to make assumptions about how the DNA of humans change with respect to time. And where we ended last week is making the point, well, we know something's up with these genetics models, that the systematic errors have to be much bigger than the statistical errors. I should probably stop. I'm assuming everybody knows the difference between a statistical error and a systematic error. Maybe I should see a show of hands. How many know what I'm talking about? Okay, one, two. I'm assuming, okay, let me give an explanation. A statistical error is where the scientist goes in and he makes measurements at many different times in many different ways, gets different measurements, and then looks at the scatter in the measurements. The scatter in the measurements are what we call the statistical errors. Now, the systematic errors is where there's some effect that shifts all the measurements up or shifts all the measurements down. And so you got this statistical scatter in the measurements, but on top of that, there may be effects in the environment or the instruments that you're using to make the measurements or the mathematical model. And there could be assumptions built in to the model. There could be instrumental effects. There could be unknown environmental effects that shift all the measurements up or shift all the measurements down. I'll give you one quick example of that. There was a site in Australia called the Jimnian Cave where they were able to find artifacts that they knew had to be associated with anatomically modern humans. And so they used optical luminescence measurements and thermal luminescence measurements to try to determine the dates for those artifacts. And the dates are coming back about 60,000 years ago, plus or minus 3,000 years. But the plus or minus 3,000 was simply the scatter amongst the different thermal and optical luminescence methods. And what these methods are, it's basically telling you how long ago the lights were on. I'll give you an example of, say, optical or thermal luminescence. When our boys were really young, I put on their ceiling phosphorescent stars that basically showed the Little Dipper and the Big Dipper, because I basically want to teach my sons, if you ever lost in the woods at night and the stars are out, this is how you can figure out which direction is north. And I figured, hey, if I put it on their ceiling, they're going to be able to figure this out over time. Every time they go to bed, they're going to see the stars. But it also proved useful because, you know, we would put our sons to bed, and we would go upstairs. What we noticed is that they would turn the light on and read one of their favorite books. And so we would come down and said, hey, you've not been sleeping. You've been reading one of your books. They couldn't figure out how we could tell. Well, I mean, if we look up the stars and the stars are still luminous, that means there had to be lights on. If the lights were off, those stars, that luminescence would have dimmed, and we would have known that they hadn't turned the lights on. So yeah, well, that's basically what they were doing with these artifacts. They're dating how long they've been buried. But notice they're assuming that the artifacts have been permanently buried. You know, what if some bear comes along or some event happens, a tectonic event or whatever, and those relics that were buried get exposed to sunlight? Then that means that it's going to shift the measurements, and it's going to shift the measurements to make them look older than what they should be. And so what happened was, and by the way, this was used against us with reasons to believe, because our model was basically saying no humans entered Australia until about 35 to 40,000 years ago. And they said, this is 60,000. This totally disrupts your model of the scattering of humanity out of the Middle Eastern region. And I kept making the point, yeah, but it's all based on optical and thermal luminescence. All you're looking at are the statistical errors, not the possible systematic errors. How this got resolved is 3 decades later, somebody looked at one of these artifacts and said, hey, there's a tiny amount of carbon associated with this artifact. We can do radiocarbon dating on this. So they did the radiocarbon dating, and the date came back 3,000 years ago, plus or minus about 200 years, basically demonstrating those optical and thermoluminescence dates were off by a factor of 2,000%. So the statistical error was about plus or minus 10%. The systematic error was plus or minus 2,000%. And so, you know, dropping the age from 60,000 to 3,000, that's a big deal. Okay. Well, one of the reasons why even people who disagree with our model, reasons to believe, recognize maybe you guys have got something, is the field experiments don't match what you expect from the genetics models. And you know, I briefly introduced to you at the end of last week that scientists have been taking advantage of a really desolate location, the Kerguelen Archipelago. There's about 100 islands in the South Pacific Ocean. This is what the main island looks like. It's quite a big island, 93 miles east to west, 75 miles north to south, and associated with it are a bunch of small islands. And so what biologists have been doing is taking advantage of these small islands. And what's interesting about these small islands, they're incredibly barren. In fact, this is the only village in the entire archipelago. Porto Franco, the French own this archipelago. And so this is the only habitation in the entire archipelago. Its population ranges from 45 in the winter to 100 people in the summertime. So not a lot of people there, and for good reason. This is what the landscape looks like. And you say, does anything grow there? Yes, they got grass that grows there, and even food. They got Kerguelen cabbages. Now, the cabbages are nothing like the cabbages you get in the store. They're basically tiny little things that are on the ground, but you can collect them all and get some food. And they do have a greenhouse in this village where they actually raise food. And hey, it's not that bad. The average temperature is around 40 degrees. And so typically it's above freezing. But the really bad part is they got really high winds, obviously, because in the middle of the ocean. And so the winds just blow incessantly. But what ecologists have been doing is saying, hey, we can actually test these models. What we do is we can take a mammal species or a bird species and put them on one of these islands where there's no other animals anything like them. So the first experiment they did was with a pair of sheep, these mouflon sheep. It's a unique breed of mountain sheep. And so they took a male, they took a female, they put them on the Isle of Haut, which is this small island, the bottom arrow points you to the island of Haut, H-U-A-U-T-E. And so they put two of these sheep there, one a male and one a female. But what they did is they very carefully measured the genome of the male and the female. So they had the DNA of the original male and female. They put them on this island, and there's grass and cabbages there for them to eat. There's no other mammals there, so there's nothing really to disturb them. And they let them reproduce. And so multiple generations went by. And so they would come back, say 12 generations later, and measure the DNA of all the descendants of these two. Then they would contrast them with the mathematical models. What they discovered was this, that you get way more genetic diversity in the field experiment than you do with the genetics models. Basically making the point that genetics models will over-interpret. So you get way more genetic diversity when the models predict, which means that if you look at the genetic diversity of a present population, you will overestimate the number of descendants of the original population. So they knew right away it started with two, but the models were telling them it had to be more than 10 in the original population. This caused them to do other experiments. So they looked at a rare horse species, and this is the Przewalski horse. And they looked at the DNA. There's not very many of these horses on the planet. So they measured the DNA of four lineages of the Przewalski horse. And they discovered that these four diverged much earlier than the known divergent time. Because, you know, these horses have been around for a while. And we knew that these four lineages came from one lineage just about 6 to 8,000 years ago, but the genetics measurements showed that it had to be tens of thousands of years earlier. So again, it's saying you get a date that's much earlier than the real date, which basically saying when they say, hey, we humans had to be descended from a pair that lived a million years ago, that million years is an overestimate. It's a date much less than that. Now, it's not just this horse and that sheep that causes them to draw this conclusion. They looked at orangutans living in Sumatra and living in Borneo. Now in Sumatra, it's a really big island in Indonesia. They have only 7,000 wild orangutans, but in Borneo, they got 45,000. But here's what's interesting. The 7,000 Sumatrans show way more genetic diversity than the 45,000 in Borneo. All the genetics models would predict the greater the population, the greater the diversity you can see. But with these orangutans, it's the opposite. The small population has more diversity than the large population. And one of the geneticists that was studying these orangutans wrote this in the British journal Nature. He said, "We don't fully understand the relationship between genetic diversity and the population size." Now, I say this to you because you're going to run into people saying scientists have proven that it's impossible that all of humanity could be descended from one man and one woman. The story of Adam and Eve in the Bible must be an allegory. It can't be literally true. Well, it's not just these three species that have been studied. Today, we now have field experiments on eight distinct species, the mouflon sheep, gray whales, blue whales, the Przewalski horses, the copper red horses. They even did one on a reptile, the common toad, white-tailed deer, and white-tailed eagle. So they got a bird, they got a reptile, and they got six different species of mammals. Now, the one thing they discovered by looking at these eight species was they found a relationship, a correlation between the extra genetic diversity and the generation time. The generation time is a time between an individual in that species being born and being able to reproduce. And what they discovered in looking at these eight different species, the longer the generation time, the greater the generation of genetic diversity. So for a species where we're talking 3 months between the time that they're born and they can give birth, you get less genetic diversity, say for a white-tailed deer, where it's 1 year. Or when you look at the orangutan, it's more than a year. And so, or the whales, it's quite a bit more than a year. The longer the time it takes for them to be born to the point where they can reproduce, the greater the generation of genetic diversity. And they noted that this correlation works regardless of how large the current population of the species is. Because when you look at this, with toads, you got lots of individuals. With blue whales, you don't have very many individuals at all. And so they said the correlation is not so much how big the present population is, it's really the generation time that determines greater the amount of genetic diversity. So just to summarize, the longer the mammal species generation time, the greater the divergence between the actual and genetically derived dates back to the original ancestral pair. Now, let's look at us modern human beings, anatomically modern human beings. What is our generation time? Well, today you could argue that in some countries of the world, it's getting close to 30 between the time that they're born and the time that they actually reproduce. However, if you go back 200 years ago, it was more like 18 or 20. And wondering why it's taking longer for people today to go from being born to actually reproducing, it's our technology. Our technology means you need a lot more preparation for your career than people lived 200 years ago. If you go back 200 years, most children wound up going into the same profession as their parents. And so they would be trained by their parents and go into the same profession. If your mother was a nurse, you would become a nurse. If your dad was a blacksmith, you would become a blacksmith. If he was a farmer, you'd become a farmer. Now, children today know that's a prescription for unemployment, because whatever employment your dad has, by the time you develop, that particular profession will probably be obsolete. I mean, think back. Go back about 60 years, 70 years, we had elevator operators. So if your dad was an elevator operator, you say, oh, I'm going to follow in my dad's footsteps. Guess what? No human being is necessary to run an elevator today. Or put yourself in the 21st century. Your dad is a long-distance truck driver. What do you think is going to happen in the next 20 years? Combination of GPS satellites that can know the position of every vehicle in the world to within 1 or 2 centimeters, plus artificial intelligence, means we're not going to need people to drive cars or trucks anymore. We're going to be able to totally automate that, just like we were able to eliminate all the people running elevators. And so if you know someone that wants to follow in their dad's footsteps of being a truck driver or a taxi driver or an Uber driver, that's not a good thing to think about. It's not going to be too long before all those occupations will be eliminated. But that basically has forced young people to, you know, study longer, work longer, to prepare for a career that's not going to go obsolete. So my own family, I mean, at my age, I should be a grandfather, right? Well, the problem is both of my sons decided to pursue careers that took a lot of training. My younger son was in university education for 10 years before he finally got to develop in a career. I couldn't believe it. Here he is getting a doctoral degree, but after he gets a doctoral degree, he first has to do an externship. What I discovered as a dad, an externship is where you work for a year and you get paid zero. But if you want to actually be able to pursue a career as a clinical neuropsychologist. You got to put in a year at hospitals. And of course, my son would come to me and say, Dad, I'm having to drive from hospital A to hospital B to hospital C every day. I need some financial help. And I said, hey, well, okay, I know you're going to have to do this for a year for free. We're going to help you. Okay, he gets through his externship. Now he qualifies for an internship. Okay, internship is just like the externship, only now you get paid $24,000 a year instead of zero. And, but you still got to drive to all these different hospitals, which means you need a car. And you know, even trying to go to the grocery store and support yourself on $24,000 a year, let alone paying rent. And so, you know, my wife and I had to support him through his internship. And after that, he was able to apply for a postdoctoral fellowship. Oh, and I says, okay, finally we're not going to have to financially support him, right? Because now he's going to be making $60,000 a year as a postdoc. But he lands an appointment in Napa. Okay, try living in Napa on $60,000 a year. So we had to support him through that as well. So he had to go through all that after his doctoral degree before he could actually get a job where he could support himself. Finally, running to this, I talked to my sons and their friends, and they're basically saying, you know, marriage seems out of the question. I just can't afford to be married. That means I got to support a second person, and we have a family. Dad, do you know how much it costs to raise a child? I says, yeah, I got a pretty good idea because of what it costs for the two of you. Been supporting him literally for 35 to 40 years. So this idea of launching your children at age 18, forget that. That's now totally obsolete. So if you want to know why the birth rate is dropping all over the world, even in places like Kenya, it's been dropping. It's just because our technology has reached a point where we can't prepare for a career like that anymore. I don't know why I got off on that tangent. Okay. But yeah, we human beings, we have the longest generation time. I mean, most animals, it's 1 year. Some mammals, like the chimpanzees, it's a few years. Elephants have a long, almost as long a generation time as we human beings. When you look at, say, the Neanderthals, some people think that their generation time was 7 or 8 years. But for us, we're looking at 20 to 25 years. And again, the longer the generation time, the greater the generation of genetic diversity beyond what the genetics models would predict. So you would expect the greatest discrepancy of all would be for anatomically modern humans. Less so for the Denisovans, less so for the Neanderthals, even less so for Homo erectus. And therefore, we need to look at these genetics models and say, okay, when we look at the dates and we look at the error bars do not take into account these systematic effects. So we need to consider that and also recognize with humans, we're going to get the least realistic results from these models. Okay, having done that, I'm going to show you the models. Now, these are the models for what we call mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosome Adam. And so what we're basically doing is tracing back by looking at the genetic diversity, say, of all the people in the world and trying to figure out how far back do we have to go to where we're all descended from a single woman. Now, what makes this work is all of us have mitochondrial DNA in every cell of our body, but we only get that mitochondrial DNA from our mothers. Your dad has nothing to do with it. Only your mother contributes to your mitochondrial DNA, which actually makes for a simpler genetics model, because we can look at the mitochondrial DNA of the population today and realize that diversity only happens on the female side. We can ignore what's going on with the men and basically trace based on the genetic diversity of our mitochondrial DNA, how far back we have to go in time. So we're all descended from one woman. And so these are the dates they get. 108,000 years ago, 157,000 years ago, plus or minus 39,000 years, 143,000 years ago, plus or minus 34,000 years, and 123,000 years ago, plus or minus 25,000 years. So this explains why people are saying we all have to be descended from one woman that probably lived before the beginning of the last ice age. Because the dates are coming, well, 108,000, that's at the end of the last ice age, but these dates of 157 and 143 would put you into the ice age previous to this ice age. 123,000, that's right at the very beginning of the last ice age. But what you're overlooking is that these statistical errors you see here are just that, statistical errors. There's no account of the systematic errors. So for example, these models are making assumptions. Like one of the models basically assumes, well, we're going to look at the rate at which mutations happen in the human population today. And incidentally, the vast majority of mutations that we see in the human genome are neutral. What that means is they don't hurt you, they don't benefit you. A small, tiny percentage are harmful. And so you know things like sickle cell anemia, that's a genetic defect. And so we do see, we're actually looking at trying to treat genetic defects that show up in the population. And what's really new is that they're actually able to use genetically altered viruses to go in and correct a genetic defect in a person that's alive. Hasn't been done yet, but they've done it on mice, where they look at genetic defect in a mouse, and they basically re-engineer a virus to actually go into that mouse and infect it in such a way that it corrects a genetic defect. So maybe 10 years from now, 20 years from now, we can actually correct the genetic defects that are in the human population. That would be a good thing. What I'm concerned about, and the geneticists that are part of our scholar community are concerned about, is that people may use the same technique to say, can we build a superhuman? So take one of you, for example, and maybe boost your IQ by a factor of 40. And then you'd be able to do more intellectually challenging things. Or you're into sports, well, let's genetically alter you in such a way that you can run faster than other human beings and be able to perform. Now, what concerns us is that people looking at that kind of research are basically assuming we humans are not optimally designed. And so we're going to improve upon the design of human beings. But by focusing on only one factor, how fast you can run, how high is your IQ, or they might be looking at, let's see if we can genetically alter human beings so they can comfortably spend 15 hours a day sitting in front of a screen, because that's kind of what people like to do these days anyway, right? So, and they realize we can design the human backbone in such a way it can tolerate longer periods of sitting. Now, all this assumes that the human being doesn't want to do anything else. All you want to do is run a 3.5 minute mile. You don't want to be able to walk, you don't want to be able to sit or stand. And so our backbone is designed, genetically designed, so it can do lots of things comfortably, but it can't do any of those things optimally. And so our backbone is not optimally designed for speed running or endurance running. It's not optimally designed for sitting in front of a computer, or it's not optimally designed for being able to stand in front of a large audience. You know, one of the things we notice about the human backbone, it's very well designed for walking, not so well designed for standing. And hey, I just challenge one of you, give a lecture that lasts 3 hours while you do is stand in front of the audience. And I've gotten to the point now when I'm traveling and I know I'm going to be doing back-to-back lectures, I say, I need a stool up here. I will stand while I'm lecturing, but during the Q&A, I'm going to sit in the stool. Why do I do that? I know my backbone's not optimally designed to stand for long periods at a time, but I could give myself a break. The wonderful thing about the human backbone, it's very well designed to do a combination of sitting, sleeping, standing, walking, running. It can do all those things, not optimally, but it can do it all, what we call suboptimally. And this is the problem with people actually looking at genetics and saying, can we make a better human? Well, they're not recognizing that our Creator designed our bodies with multiple tasks in mind. Because when you know, you change your mind. You might like running a mile for the first few years of your life, then after a while you say, you know what, I'm going to quit that, I'm going to do something else. But if your body is only designed to do one thing, you're kind of stuck to doing just that one thing. And I'm not so certain either that by boosting everybody's IQ by a factor of 40 points is a good thing. I've lived most of my life around people with very high IQs. A lot of them are not very likable. A lot of them really struggle getting along with their fellow human beings. And so if we all were like that, that could make social engagement a lot more difficult. In fact, some of them really don't like social engagement. So always look at the trade-offs. And that's the wonderful thing about the human body. It's optimally designed with all the different functions that we would like to do, but also all the optimal functions that God wants us to be able to do. And so when you try to improve upon something that I would argue is optimally designed for multiple purposes, you wind up with unintended consequences. But by all means, I'm certainly in favor of correcting genetic defects. That's using the technology where God intends that it be used. So I think God gave us the capacity, for example, to be able to cure diseases that are, you know, afflicting us. Nobody gets smallpox anymore, thanks to our technology. Okay, so these are the dates you get from mitochondrial Eve. But again, I want to remind you that these dates ignore completely the systematic effects. And I think for obvious reason, because I can suggest some systematic effects, but I can't guarantee that I know all the systematic effects. In fact, when I engage geneticists, I basically tell them, hey, as an astrophysicist, when I publish a paper, I have to quote both the statistical error, the systematic error, and I've got to name all the systematic effects. And their response is, well, we know of a couple of systematic effects. We have no idea what the errors on there are, and we certainly are not confident that we know all the systematic effects. It says, you guys in astronomy, you got it easy. You're studying something really simple, a star. It's just a huge ball of hydrogen and helium gas with a tiny amount of heavy metals added to it. You guys actually know all the systematic effects, and you can actually measure the errors on the systematic effects. That can really only be done in sciences like physics and astronomy. It really can't be done in biology. However, I think it's important that we actually point out, hey, there are systematic effects. We know a couple of them. You need to take this into account. And incidentally, we've been able to do the same thing with Adam. And this is the Y chromosome. Now, all humans have mitochondrial DNA, only males have Y chromosome DNA. Now, there are people who pointed out there are exceptions. Some women actually have a slight amount of the Y chromosome, but we're talking like one woman out of a million, so it really is an insignificant effect. But yes, because you get your Y chromosome for your dad and only happens on the male side, we can actually trace the dates back to when the first man lived. Now notice you get approximately the same dates as you get for the mitochondrial Eve. And so this has actually been noted in the scientific literature. Hey, maybe there's some credence to what the Bible says, because notice we're getting the same date back to the first woman as we get for the same date back to the first man. Well, it's basically the same rough date. And again, the dates are a lot rougher. And you notice here that the statistical errors are a little smaller. The reason why the statistical errors are smaller, you're only looking at half the population, not the entire population. With mitochondrial DNA, you're looking at the entire population. Here you're looking at half the population, so the error bars are smaller, but very roughly the dates are the same. But again, the systematic effects, based on what we know from these animal studies, tells us these dates are upper limits to how far back you can go in time. It could be less, it's unlikely to be more. But what you'll see in the scientific literature, when geneticists actually honestly talk about the systematic errors, they're saying, we got the date nailed down to where the first human beings lived. They lived somewhere between 45,000 years ago and 250,000 years ago. And I would argue that is an honest assessment. And that kind of brackets it because the radioisotope dating will give you accurate dates back to about 45,000 years ago. But there's a gap between 45,000 and 250,000 where we have no radioisotope dating tool. You're forced to use these other methods that have got huge systematic effects. But once you get as far back as 250,000, that's now where you actually have a radioisotope date. So that kind of gives you the limits. Humans have been around for at least 45,000 years. They've not been around longer than 250,000 years. But the methods we have really are not able to pin things down much more accurately if we do acknowledge not only the statistical errors, but the systematic errors. Okay, where we're going to go from here is looking at Noah's Ark. And this, again, is another huge challenge. Noah's Ark, is it too fantastic? And also, what I'm going to do next week is look at these days for Adam, look at these days for Eve, and figure out where can we nail down Noah. Now, we know that Noah is more recent than Adam. How much more recent is he than Adam? And is it really true about Noah's Ark that the story is just too fantastic? For example, the Ark seems to be too small to fit every pair of land animal on board. It seems to be too large for Noah and his family to build, too large to be seaworthy, and hey, when it lands on the mountains of Ararat, that just doesn't seem to be feasible at all. Namely, ships don't float uphill, they float downhill. And hey, it landed at a place that would be uphill. How did that ever happen? There are really good answers to all those four questions. It'll probably take us a few weeks to get through those answers. I'll stop there. We'll take questions. As usual, we'll take questions from here, people that are here in person, and alternate with people that are joining us online from around the world. But Mark, it looks like we got an online question.
We do. We have several. Jamalama, I heard that NASA cut 40% from the Chandra telescope budget. Is that true, and will it adversely affect NASA's quest for knowledge?
Well, there's been major cuts, not just for the Chandra Space Telescope. You haven't heard about it. That's a telescope that makes observations at X-ray wavelengths. And currently, it's the best telescope for making X-ray measurements. And if you go online, you'll notice that NASA frequency will look, give you a photo, an image, one that's taken by Chandra at X-ray wavelengths, one that's taken by the Hubble Space Telescope at visible wavelengths, then they'll throw in one from the James Webb Space Telescope at infrared wavelengths. And what they're doing is they're taking the best telescope at each wavelength region that's orbiting in outer space, and basically combining the images, and you do that, you get a lot of information about the galaxy you're looking at, the star you're looking at, the star-forming region you're looking at, the pulsar you're looking at. And so having the budget cut for the Chandra Space Telescope will hurt. It's also maybe a way to actually get a better X-ray telescope up there, because that's one thing that astronomers have pointed out. We got a really good telescope in space, infrared wavelengths, one of visible wavelengths. We sure could use a better X-ray telescope. Now, this is not unique to the Chandra program. Basically, science research has been cut all across the board. In fact, there were really draconian cuts, say, in the Ninth National Science Foundation budget. And this has had a ripple literally all over the world. The good news is some of that funding is now being restored. The other piece of good news is private charities have been stepping in to say, hey, we want this research supported. So, for example, a number of major astronomy research endeavors are not supported by the government. They're supported by private donors. So the Keck telescopes on the top of Hawaii, two 400-inch telescopes that are linked together, that's 100% funded by private money. Even the maintenance of those telescopes is funded by private money. So, and basically the new administration is saying we need to structure things so that these scientific endeavors are more supported by private funding, basically arguing that this is going to engender some competition among scientists. Hey, if you want to attract private funding, private funders can give their money anywhere they want. And so you really need to show that you've got the best opportunity for scientific research. But hey, there's a good chance that Chandra funding might be replaced. There's also a good chance that maybe we can get NASA to put together an even better X-ray telescope than the Chandra telescope. So personally, I'm not that pessimistic. And yes, scientists always cry when their funding is cut. And they seldom rejoice when they get extra funding they don't expect. So one story I can remember, this is from when I was a graduate student, is a bunch of French astronomers wanted to build this big telescope. It was basically where they had a stationary, tiltable screen, huge screen that they could tilt and basically focus the incoming radio radiation on a fixed receiver that was planted in the ground. And this is the cheapest way to get a high sensitivity. And so they went to the French government and said, surely you're going to want to fund this. This is the best bang for the buck you can get. We get the most collecting area per dollar. You know what happened? The French government said, we've made a decision on how much money to give you to build this Nansei telescope. We acknowledge that this is the most bang for the buck. We acknowledge this is going to put France ahead of everybody else in terms of this kind of radio astronomy. But now we've decided we're going to give you not all you request, not half that you request, not a quarter of what you request, we're going to give you zero. So you can imagine, those astronomers walked away saying, they're acknowledging this is a great project, but they're not going to give us a single dime. Well, the French astronomers ahead of this said, you know, this really is the most bang for the buck because, you know, everything is fixed. Remember, you got one that's tiltable, and we're looking at low frequency, so it's not expensive to put together the wires we need to make this a huge, you know, radio astronomy collecting area. So he said, you know, we're all in Paris. How about if we go door to door and get all the housewives here in Paris to give us all their excess coat hangers? Now, we're only going to take metal coat hangers, but we know we can restructure those coat hangers to build this array. That's a true story. The array was built with coat hangers that were donated by families all over Paris. So they didn't need a dime of the government's money. Sometimes things are creative. In fact, I can share this story when I was a research fellow at Caltech, is that we were doing radio astronomy research, and what you had in Virginia and West Virginia was a National Radio Astronomy Observatory, and they got a generous grant from the government every year to do their radio astronomy research. That same government agency gave us 1/10 of what they gave to the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. They said, hey, you guys at Caltech have a reputation for being creative and being able to figure out how to do the same thing on the cheap. So we're only going to give you 1/10 of what we're giving our government observatory, and we want you to do the same thing or better. And if you beat them out, guess what? We're going to reduce the budget of the NRAO because we're going to say, hey, Caltech could do it for this money. Why can't you do it for that? By the way, we'll give you double the money we gave to Caltech, but we want double the results. So they're basically purposely setting up this competition. But for that reason, I recall going up to the observatory, and I said, well, where are the engineering help? And they said, notice when we interviewed you, we asked you, can you solder? Can you weld? There's a reason for that. We don't have any engineers here. We don't have a budget for engineers. You're the astronomer. You got to do everything. And really, it wound up doing everything, because I was trying to link together these three radio telescopes, and they weren't linking. So I says, hey, something's got to be wrong with the way these telescopes are wired together. And it was all done in these underground cable boxes. And so the two telescopes were not connecting. I went down into the cable box, began to crawl through this thing. It was dark, it was muddy, wasn't very pleasant at all. But then I found this giant lizard who was eating the insulation on the cable. So I said, okay, that's why it's not working. I need to get rid of that lizard, need to repair the wire, then everything will be fine. That worked out too. Until the cows discovered that they liked polyethylene. And then we had to find some way, and that was a real problem, because the reason why Caltech got the land for these telescopes, they basically agreed with the people that were ranchers. Hey, you're able to use this government land to feed your cows, but why don't we have telescopes on the land at the same time? So we had to share the property with these cows. But that meant we had to keep checking and finding ways to put barbed wire around the polyethylene cables so they wouldn't eat the cables. Then we had a problem because it was public land, anybody could go there. So we had problems with teenagers from the local towns coming and doing a little bit of vandalism. You know how we cured that? We put signs around our telescopes, danger, incident, radiation field. They looked at that and they just left us alone. Now, teenagers might not know what incident radiation is, but you all know what that is. That's just radiation falling on the ground from the sun and the stars and all these other objects. But a teenager may not know that and think, oh boy, there's dangerous radiation here. I better stay away. So, when you're on the faculty at Caltech, you have to be resourceful, you have to be creative, and be willing to have other people copy your creativity to do things. Hey, let's get to the questions. Doug's got a question.
I see you walking back and forth. It reminds me of like when people give TED Talks. Maybe you should do that. I don't know. I'm hoping you're feeling okay. You just got out of the hospital. But reminds me of when we were over there, sometimes you'd walk away from the camera, and it was kind of funny. But my question is about the laws of nature or Mother Nature. You know, you hear about the laws of physics. Is there a branch of biology where they study, like, the laws of nature, like consciousness and, you know, like, biochemically, how consciousness and particularly instinct, how instinct can exist. It fascinates me that I think a baby giraffe can walk just a few hours after it's born. I mean, and yet humans take, well, some people can't even walk when they're like 70 years old like me. But you know what I mean? That's my question.
Good question. I've got about 50 books in my office on attempts by naturalists to explain human consciousness and the consciousness of animals. In fact, we did a program on Star Cells and God recently where we talked about that consciousness. Incidentally, all of the episodes of Star Cells and God are archived on the YouTube channel. You can watch them for free. But yeah, I remember in this one dialogue, people were saying, okay, is it possible something is happening at the quantum level in the brain that's the source of our consciousness? And the scientists who were studying that were saying, yeah, you can explain a lot at the quantum level, but not everything. So for example, we now realize that our brain is like the hardware of a computer, and it can store an amazing amount of information. But it can't explain all the software that apparently exists there, and especially can't explain the creator of the software. So, you know, what's driving the thing? And the one thing that's in common with all the books I have on trying to explain human consciousness, they speculate about all these arcane areas of physics, chemistry, and biology, where we might think the seed of consciousness exists naturalistically. But they all end up by saying, nope, that doesn't work. We really don't have a clue. But I've just finished writing a book on extraterrestrial life, extraterrestrial intelligent life, the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life, and UFOs and UAPs. And I find interesting, it's people studying extraterrestrial intelligent life and UAPs and UFOs who are drawing the conclusion, hey, something conscious seems to be behind these close encounters with UAPs, and it's not from a materialistic source. It's something from beyond materialism. And also recognizing that's true of that phenomena, it's also true of us, because what they're noticing is that, you know, all these people believe that there's life after death, and now we're doing experiments on near-death encounters, and it really does seem like our consciousness is not material. It's something beyond nature. And this is what the Bible teaches, that we humans have two natures, a physical nature and a spiritual nature. And your physical body is wearing out. If you don't believe that, look around at us people who are older. We're wearing out. But when our bodies rot and decay, we continue to exist. In fact, what's interesting is what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4. He says, as humans, our physical bodies are decaying. But when the Holy Spirit comes into our life, our spiritual nature gets greater and greater as time goes on. He says, the physical body decays slowly. It takes many years. So, for example, if you visit your friend a month from now, they're going to look the same as they do today. But if you go, say, 6 years without seeing your friend, you're going to see your friend and say, boy, you sure look old. And they'll probably say the same thing about you. But it takes literally years before you notice, hey, there's decay going on. What does Paul say about our spirit? If we're walking in the Spirit of the Lord with the Holy Spirit working within us, you can see enhancement of the spiritual person literally day by day. So day by day, we see the growth. The body decays, the spirit is growing, which is why we who are followers of Jesus Christ, in Paul's words, can rejoice over the fact that we're getting older. Because spiritually, we're getting more beautiful. We're getting more conformed to the character of Christ on a daily basis, while our physical body is just slowly decaying. So who cares about the slow decay because of how much is going on in the spirit realm? But it's an argument that, again, there's something beyond the spirit realm. And you said something at the beginning of your question that I've completely forgotten. If it's not important, we can forget it. But if it is, come back and let me know what it is.
Okay. Ronald Hawking wants to know if Adam and Eve had a language, and were they able to cook since they needed nutrition?
Well, they must have had a language because they were communicating with God, they were communicating with one another, they were talking with one another. I think they got language capability very quickly, and I think that's also a reason why God created Adam and Eve, not as young babies that needed to grow, but he created them fully functional from the get-go. And I can't tell you how often I run into people on my social media that say, hey, the universe could be young, even though it appears to be old, because God created Adam and Eve old. God did not create Adam and Eve old. He created them fully functional. Why did he make them full size and fully functional? Because he wanted to communicate with them quickly. I mean, those of us who have had children, it's amazing how quickly your baby is able to communicate with you. I mean, my two sons were communicating with us in full paragraphs when they were 18 months old. However, they're working with a brain that's one-third the size of an adult. Can you imagine how quickly Adam and Eve would be able to accumulate knowledge capability with a brain that's three times bigger than that of a baby? That's my argument for why God did not create Adam and Eve as babies. He made them full size. But because they didn't come from the womb of a woman, their body size would not be an indicator of age. Nowhere in the Bible is there any evidence of God creating things with the appearance of age. Adam and Eve are the exceptions. They're the only humans that did not come from the womb of a woman. As I look at you, your body size tells me the minimum age that you have, because I knew all of you came from the womb of a woman. So I know it takes time for you to go from a foot and a half tall to 6 feet tall. But for Adam and Eve, it's literally zero, because God made them 5 or 6 feet tall from the get-go. I believe he did that because he wanted to be able to communicate with them quickly, not wait several months, but actually have them gain sophisticated language capability right away. And that also explains how Adam and Eve were communicating with one another at such an early stage. There's probably more to the question than that, but that's all I can remember. I got it, good. Okay, Steve.
Hi, Hugh, good to be here again.
Can you get a little closer to the mic?
Yes, I will, thank you.
Thank you.
I enjoy your presentation of error bars, yet they've always somewhat made me feel uneasy when I see error bars anywhere, and there's maybe some assumptions that I need to address that you could help out with. And that is, there are systematic errors. System, I take it, doing with what do we know about the system, biological or whatever. There are statistical errors. Those things of variation, which we have found happen consistently across what we look at. But then there are also sigma values. And I'm wondering if you can give an example, specifically one thing that bringing at least two or maybe the sigma values together. And also, see, the error bars, I'm wondering if they're fuzzy on each end, what actually makes them? We had four different studies for today on two different things on time. So I can understand how different studies might be averaged, but when there's one study, what are they doing specifically to establish an error bar? How established is that error bar? And do the error bars relate to sigma values?
Yes, good question. The sigma basically looks at the combination of systematic plus statistical errors. The good sigmas do that. But often when you're reading the scientific literature, the sigma is basically only looking at the statistical error. And therefore, you need to be cautious when you say, hey, and for those of you who don't know what Steve is talking about, you basically have a bunch of measurements. You look at the scatter of those measurements, and then you get the average, and you ask yourself, okay, how far from that average can you go and be certain of the result? So like one sigma is where you're now 67% certain that the right answer falls between a particular range. And typically when you see measurements like this, go back here, plus or minus 7,000, plus or minus 15,000, that's a one sigma measurement. So it's basically saying that the chances that the measurement by Posnick is gonna be anywhere from, say, 153,000 years ago and 125,000 years ago, there's a 67% chance the correct number will fall in there. And oops, that was 18,000, actually a little more. So it would be like 156,000 and 120,000. All I'm doing is putting the 18,000 up and the 18,000 down. Now, however, if I want to be more certain, I go with what's called the two sigma result, which means I'm going to double that 18,000 to 36,000. And so I take the 138,000, I add 36,000, I subtract 36,000, but now I'm 95% certain that the right answer falls between those two ranges. Three sigma means I'm now 99.7% certain. Now, in astronomy, you're not allowed to publish a claim, hey, I've demonstrated that this indeed is true, unless I can show that the alternative is five sigma away, which means that my measurement, the noise of my measurement, it needs to be five sigma away before I can say, hey, I've claimed it. So, for example, what I learned in radio astronomy is that you're doing on a radio telescope, and you actually see a little bump up, and it goes down, you see some noise. You look at that bump and you say, I've discovered a new radio source. However, you're not allowed to publish it unless the size of that bump is five times greater than the ripple and the noise that you see in either side. Now, the reason why we insist on five sigma, which basically says there's only about one chance in a million that this is not a true discovery, is what happens when you're going surfing. Now, some of you here have actually surfed, right? And one reason why I don't like board surfing and prefer bodyboarding, you gotta wait a long time when you're on a board to get a four sigma wave. What do you mean by a four sigma wave? A wave that's four times higher than the average height of a wave. Only one wave in 10,000 is four times higher than the average height. And so you see these guys and gals out there in the waves, and they're basically spending most of their time sitting on the board waiting for that, you know, wave that comes by. And hey, if you got all day, you will get one of those four sigma waves. However, you're not going to get a five sigma wave in one day unless you got a tidal wave coming. So that's a little bit of an idea what sigma means. Now, to really be precise, so you have to add not just the statistical errors, but the systematic errors. And Steve, I think you've raised the point. Systematic errors are hard to identify. And even when you do identify, it's hard to determine what the error is. And the reason why you don't see a lot of discussion in the biological literature on systematics is biology is way, way more complicated than astronomy and physics. In astronomy and physics, we typically know what all the systematic effects are, and we can measure them. And so in our papers, we give a detailed discussion of the systematic errors, the statistical errors, and we quote the sigma. It's a combination of the two. However, if you have no idea what the systematics are, or you name two, and you figure there's probably 10 more, that explains why you say, hey, since we don't have much knowledge on this, we're only going to give you the statistical error. For there, we know what we're talking about. We don't know what we're talking about on the systematics. On the other hand, I've been encouraging my friends in the life sciences, look, at least say something in your paper about what you think some of the systematics may be. And hey, and even if you're off by a little bit, you're at least allowing the reader to understand, hey, this could be a huge factor which could disturb the real answer to what's going on here. And just simply admit that something like genetics is incredibly complicated. But it is interesting from my perspective that notice we're getting the same approximate date for the Y chromosome atom as we get for the mitochondrial DNA Eve, which tells us that maybe we don't know all the systematics, but it seems like the same kind of stuff is going on both ends. Or to put it another way, it means that women are not behaving a whole lot differently than men. And actually, one of the things that really drives a systematic is how women choose their spouse, how men choose their spouse. And I believe this is one of the biggest drivers of errors in genetics, is the fact that we're not like most mammals. Most mammals will pick any spouse that they can find. That's not true of humans. We tend to be quite selective. We're looking for certain features. and those features are not going to be random. And that explains why when Livingston first went into Central Africa, he was stunned to discover that there was a tribe of Africans that an average height is 7 feet, right next to a tribe of Africans that an average height of 3.5 feet. How did that happen? Nobody who was short would ever marry somebody who was tall, and nobody who was tall would marry somebody who was short. And so it was really going on. There was a cultural bias in these two tribes, where one bias was, hey, the shorter you are, the more valuable you are, and the other tribe was the opposite. The taller you are, the more valuable you are, because they're basically focused on different things. So there are advantages to being short. There are advantages to being tall. We have a gal, our office is only 5 feet tall. Says, Hugh, you keep talking about this. What's the advantage of only being 5 feet tall? So if you're 5 feet tall, you're not gonna have back problems like people that are 6 feet tall. The taller you are, the more damaging the falls are gonna be when you trip and fall. And so if you're only 5 feet tall, you don't damage your body to the same degree. It's the law of gravity. The taller you are, the more injuries that you're gonna suffer and the more strain is gonna be on the bones. And hey, since we're bipedal, the taller your height, the greater the weight of your bones, and the weight of your bones goes up with the square of your height. So there's a huge penalty for being tall. But hey, if you're tall, it's easy to change the light bulbs in the ceiling, right? Whereas someone who's 5 feet tall has to get a ladder and they might fall off that ladder. And so I'm glad that my sons are much taller than I am. I have them change all the light bulbs so I don't have to get up on a ladder. So, but different cultures will stress, you know, different things in different ways. But there's one reason why these models are suspect in terms of their actual dates, is that they're not taking into account we humans do not reproduce like other mammals. We don't reproduce like the birds. There's a lot going on in our culture that determines how we reproduce, how many children we have, what kinds of children we have, what we want them to do, and consequently, how they'll reproduce. That's just one idea of how complicated things are. All of you are parents already know that.
Well, we have a question from Jamalama. Genesis 1:29-30 says that God provided vegetation for the diet of all animals. How does that comport with what we understand from science? Is there a contradiction? If not, how?
Yeah, I do address that in some detail in the book Navigating Genesis, because the word there is referring to green vegetation. So it's basically saying, I've given green vegetation as food for all life. And basically as a command to Adam and Eve and humanity, hey, I'm putting you in charge of all the life on planet Earth, and putting you in charge of all of its resources, but with respect to the life, please take special care of the green vegetation. Basically making the point, if you don't take really good care of the green vegetation, nobody gets to eat. And it's simply a statement that the green vegetation, we understand today as photosynthetic organisms, that's the base of the food chain. So it's the photosynthetic organisms that are taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and water from the earth and minerals in the earth and making sugars, starches, and fats. And, carnivores don't eat those plants, but they eat creatures that do eat those plants. And so that's the base of the food chain. If we don't take good care of the base of the food chain, nobody gets to eat. But a lot of people have interpreted that passage that before Adam and Eve sinned, all animals were vegetarian. No, I think that verse is simply stating, hey, you better take care of the green vegetation, because if you don't, nobody gets to eat. And that would include the fungi. The fungi need the green vegetation to survive. All life is fundamentally dependent on photosynthetic life.
Okay, well, thank you, Doctor. And we are out of time. Can you close us in prayer, please?
Be happy to do that. Father in heaven, I just first want to thank you for what happened to me in the hospital, that really showed me even in the midst of pain, really good things can happen. Opportunities for ministry can take place. And Father, we thank you too for what you've given us in your word, what you've given us in your book of nature, how we can put the two together and really discover things, not only physically, but emotionally, intellectually, and spiritually. And we thank you, Lord, that you made us human beings in such a way that we're able to discover you, relate to you, and Lord, that as humans, we can relate to one another to a degree that's not possible for any life form here on earth. Thank you for the strong free wills you gave us. Thank you for the joy we experience as we fellowship with you and one another. And I pray, Father, all of us would leave this space and time where we'd be enhanced in our capacity to enjoy relationships with one another and, Lord, with you, and basically discover more of your life, love, and truth. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.